Hello, my name is Bruce Bolger, and I'm founder of the Enterprise Engagement Alliance. And we're here today to talk about a very important issue in the human capital world, and that is the return on investment of diversity, equity, and inclusion. There are many people that are addressing this issue, rightly so, from a social equity, a racial equity point of view. But from the standpoint of businesses, we also have to look at the bottom line. So to discuss this whole issue of the ROI of DEI, we brought together three people who have tremendous experience in this whole movement, but from different points of view. First off, starting with Renee Wood, Redwood. She is CEO of Redwood Enterprise, and she's a consulting firm that works with companies in all areas of human capital management, strategic planning, that includes DEI. And she has a long record in her career of being involved with issues of parity in the workplace. We have Eric Darasaw. He is on the advisory board. And by the way, so is Renee of the Enterprise Engagement Alliance. And he's a principal of Lazarus Advisors. And that is a boutique investment advisory company that focuses on human capital and ESG. And we have the Reverend Marvin Owens. He's chief engagement officer for Impact Shares, which is the exchange traded fund of the NAACP. So thank you very much for joining us. And I'm now going to just quickly thank our sponsors, the various companies that support our efforts. And then I'm going to stop this share and ask Renee the very first question. Renee, you've been at this a while, just a few years. I won't date you. How much progress have we really made in the corporate world to recognize that addressing social inequality is a business opportunity and not a guilt trip?
Well, thank you for welcoming me to this conversation. I think the question around how much progress has been made relative to creating more equity in our society and in the business, corporate sector in particular, we've made limited progress as measured by the ongoing lack of diversity in boardrooms, the ongoing lack of diversity in key decision-making with regard to corporate investments. I know my client colleagues who are on this conversation will talk some about that. I think part of our challenge has been that we have defined it in a way that does not prompt corporate understanding of what the return on investment could be if they embraced an equity approach to understanding how to diversify. We talk about diversifying in terms of our portfolios and how that actually enhances our ability, but yet we don't want to talk about diversifying our workforce. We talk about wanting to diversify our marketplace, but the diverse marketplace is a reflection of the diverse communities, which are the diverse communities that are not inside of these corporations in decision-making positions. So how much progress have we made? Sure, you know how much you've actually not made when you hear they say we've made 100% increase in women of color on our board of directors. That's because they've gone from 1 to 2, okay? And that's over a 15 to 20 year period. And that's more of a spin than a true accomplishment, but it's a start. And so we welcome every step. But when they won't give numbers, again, transparency and disclosure, when they fail to give you actual numbers and they only want to talk in terms of percent, you need to question what the starting baseline was. And that's a measure of progress or the lack thereof.
That makes a lot of sense. Marvin, from your standpoint, managing or being chief engagement officer for a major ETF, exchange traded fund. What kind of progress do you think we've made? And do you think businesses recognize that DEI and human capital is a business opportunity and not just an issue of undoing past injustices?
I think there are some companies that get it. The vast majority of the companies that I've encountered don't get it. They really don't understand the opportunity that DEI presents. They continue to look at DEI from the framework of a regulatory or risk kind of framework. And I get the risk understanding of this, but I think that we need to help them to reframe the idea of risk to suggest that that you're putting your company at risk if you do not take this seriously, that if you do not understand what's being asked for here. So it's not really about just the checking of boxes and getting a certain people in certain places. It really is about a whole corporate culture change, a difference. And that's something that that requires more engagement, not just from the employees, but also from the board as and the CEO. One of the things that we've encountered is that when we find out that there's a CEO that's truly committed to this, there's a real impact on the actual firm overall. And that means there are board members that are holding the CEO accountable about this. So it's all linked together. But when you come in terms of what I've seen and where the progress has been made, very limited progress. I think there's some companies that do understand and are getting it. I'm not convinced yet that this is really a general viewpoint that DEI is a business opportunity and not just something that we must do in order to keep the advocacy groups at bay or the regulators or, you know, the folks off our back. I think that has to change in order to see the real progress we want to see.
That makes total sense. Eric, from your standpoint, again, you've been involved with this for probably about 30 years as well. How effective do you think the past approaches have been of focusing, you know, EEO-1 disclosures are very important, okay? But, okay, now what? The past approach seems to have been more about, a little bit about guilt, check off the box, let's redress past injustices. And apparently that hasn't worked too well. Okay. And then some other people will say, well, wait a minute, you shouldn't have to make money to do social good. Well, except that we're in capitalism here. And if you can make money doing social good, Eric, isn't that more sustainable than simply doing good? Because as Marvin alluded, you're being kind of pushed and you end up placating people. What do you think is a more sustainable approach?
Well, I think it's been an evolution. There has been some progress. Marvin talked about the advocacy groups and they've asked for transparency. I know that the work that Renee has done as the executive director of the Glass Ceiling Commission was all about transparency, and let's have a discussion about the facts. I think the evolution of this is now moving out of an EEOC disclosure to part of the balance sheet of the corporation, and that is the investment in human capital. That's a balance sheet issue. And as you make investments in your human capital, you can't talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion and separate that from human capital. That's part of your human capital investment, right? As part of your workforce investment. And so I think it's very, very critical to of course, recognize the need to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, but it has to be in the context of the human capital investment. And that has to be discussed from the standpoint of how it impacts the balance sheet. And when you start looking at it from that standpoint, it's a different discussion. One other thing I would say is that the ESG community in measuring, in their attempt to measure diversity, equity, and inclusion are collecting some initial data, but really, in order to really get into the underlying culture of a company, it's going to require another step, and I would say multiple steps, in terms of the company analyzing where they are today and where they want to go, and applying very, very specific fundamental applications, which is pretty standard on Wall Street. You have your quantitative applications, but they also must be a fundamental review, which means talking to the company. Nobody you know, Wall Street does not just use a quantitative screen. That's, you know, to start the conversation, but the good companies go and talk to the company, go and count the amount of widgets, count the amount of sales that are being made, going out to the factories. And so that's where Wall Street has not gotten to. We're still at the very, very beginning stages.
So Renee, thank you for that, Eric. Renee, from your standpoint, why do you think we've made so little progress in 20 years? It seems almost remarkable to me that we've made so little progress. Is the approach that we've been taking, looking at it from a social activism standpoint rather than a business aspect, do you think that slowed it down a little bit? Or do you think evolution just takes time?
I think evolution takes time because we're talking about structures and systems and power and privilege. And it's not simply a corporate phenomena. It's a societal challenge in the same systems. The reason we're having this conversation is because the systems are starting to fracture, right? There's starting to be enough pinholes, right? That as we would say, shattering the glass ceiling. It took more than one bang. It took more than one crack, right? It took a consistency of pressure. And now I think we've learned, we've used strategies to get us to the point where now we have to focus on those positions of power that maintain the systems that keep, that allow us to have these conversations. And so fundamentally, why hasn't it happened? The same people in power in all societal structures are the same people in power at corporate America. They have not tied their own personal beliefs, right? Individuals, their institutions are reflections of individuals, right? So first you start with individual accountability. That goes to leadership, right? The boards. Do they own their responsibility for creating an institution that reflects the values they espouse? They all have something about, well, we believe in equality. We believe in fairness, number one. That's called organizational trust. Are you reflecting the values you espouse? You talk about diversity. We diversify our assets, okay? Well, what is human capital? That's why it's human capital, okay? So let's align some of the leadership words with actual practices. We believe in equity. Many of these companies, what do they deal with? Equity, right? Well, how do you define it? Well, apply it internally, right? So I think part of it is that there hasn't been the accountability, which is what the so-called social justice pressure, we call it social justice pressure. That's called people, right? That's called market share. So they hear it and they think about it in terms of how can I capture more of the market? If they were smart, they would recognize it would capture more of the market by bringing the market in and allowing it to enable some of their decisions. So there's been a disconnect between what individuals, and I do hold individual leadership accountable, because it's the head of the institution. As the head goes, so does the body, right? Whether it's in corporate, whether it's in government, right? Whether it's even in our so-called nonprofit community, which is also a form of capitalism because they didn't get their dollars because they were equitable. So again, sometimes we have to talk about it differently. I love the notion of it's one of the things we did with the Glass Ceiling Commission. We didn't call it a human resource, we called it human capital because we recognize that power and capital are equivalent at this point in systems and structures. But when the people understand their power, which is what's happening, that's why, as Eric said, transparency, right? Okay, they're saying we need to know more. Shareholders, we need to know more. What are you doing? Does your decision makers look like me, shareholder? Did you ask the people that look like me what we needed in the marketplace that I would actually purchase more of? And I might purchase it more if I got paid equitably within your company. So if Amazon wants people to buy through Amazon and they want their employees to buy through Amazon, they need to make sure they pay them a wage, right, that they can actually buy through. If they want Amazon to market into a particular neighborhood, guess what? I'm not going to buy from somebody I don't trust, and I'm more likely to trust the company that I saw somebody that looked like me. Why do you think they put that on the ads? They understand what they're doing. So it's not like they don't recognize the value here. It's that they've opted out and they wait to the risk, which is $192.5 million. Ask Coca-Cola, three people. Could it change the whole outcome? right? So they'll work in a risk framework as opposed to a true investment asset utilization or tapping or leveraging. It's a conscious choice.
Yes. So Marvin, the International Organization for Standardization, upon which the EEA's framework is based, they included DEI in their framework at the very beginning, not for social equity reasons. By the way, ISO is an international organization. Many of the people on these committees are from Africa or from other countries where racism is not the issue.
Oh, it is. Hold on. Let me just correct you there.
Well, I can't speak.
Okay. Racism is let's clear. Racism is a system. It's a series of systems and structures that have been embedded that root our decision-making, including our investment, whether it's in people or property. And so they have racism, but again, racism is systems, it's not people. It's the systems that deny access and opportunity, equity to all based on other factors. So I'm sorry I had to interrupt you.
Well, you have every right to do that.
Because, yeah.
That's not my area of expertise. But the point I would want to make, though, is that ISO views this as a business opportunity because it's a very simple thing. If you're going to be a white supremacist company, you're chopping off 60% of your marketplace in the United States. You're hurting your shareholders. And to your point, Renee, if you want to recruit more Asians in your company, hire Asians. If you want to have more Asian customers or African-American customers, hire them. Get them into your supply chain. Marvin, do you think that that this approach of focusing on the ROI of these activities is a more constructive, enduring approach, or do you think we're going to face the same structural issues that Renee is referring to?
Honestly, I think it's an added strategy that I think is important. I would never want to suggest that the external pressure from social advocacy organizations has not had an impact. I think it certainly has. Mm-hmm. I can remember when, I may date myself, but I remember when there was lots of conversation around apartheid in South Africa. And there were lots of groups there around the world that were talking about the need for changes to happen in South Africa in terms of their government structure. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until there was economic pressure that we began to see the kinds of movement on change that resulted in a system change that happened in South Africa. So I think that I want to make sure we're not looking at one or the other, but really both and, because it has to be both and. The social advocacy groups have to continue to put the pressure on, and the social pressure has to continue, but there also has to be a more salient conversation around the business opportunity that's being presented here. It shouldn't have to take the pressure from an outside organization for a company to understand there's a market opportunity here. There's an opportunity to be a better company. There's an opportunity to recruit bright people. There's an opportunity for our company to be stronger. Those are the kinds of conversations that I think that haven't happened, but are beginning to happen more readily in terms of companies understanding DEI, not as something that is just pressure to do something and change, but pressure to understand there is a business opportunity here that you need to recognize. The other piece of this I would suggest is now you also have the investor community who's also putting a lot of pressure on, saying we want to align our investment strategies with our values. And so when companies don't reflect that their values, then then investors are going to make some decision about where they put their money. So a company needs to understand this from that investor perspective as well. It's not just the social pressure from the outside, but honestly, the investor community is becoming almost a reflection of those social values, those social concerns that are being found in our conversations today. And I think companies now used to think, it's going to come from one place and one place alone. No, this conversation is being had at all levels of our economy. And I think it's important that companies get a grip on this and understand, hey, we can either be behind this and be reactive, or we can understand and be proactive. Last thing I'll say is, I'll let you get to my buddy Eric. When I was at the NAACP, I was there at the NAACP at the time, right after the murder of George Floyd. And so companies were coming out all over the place talking about their commitment to racial equity. And they want to stand with, the community around these issues. And they start writing checks. They start writing checks to organizations that support advocacy. But what we're having some conversations with those companies quietly. And what they were saying was, we know we stink at this. We know we don't know how to do this well. Let's figure this out. Help us understand how to do a better job of recruiting Black board members. Well, we can't find any. Well, that's crazy. You can't find any. Then you're not looking in the right places. You're not listening to your networks. You don't understand where those folks are. Well, that's the kind of thing that leads ultimately to the kind of change when there's an admission, at least, that we're not where we should be. And we need help getting there. And smart business people know how to seek out good advice. So I would add that to the conversation, but I think it's important to note that this investor community is also becoming very, very vocal and very, very active on these issues.
Well, ironically, Marvin, is that the investors have led the whole human capital movement. It was not led by labor unions. It was not led by employees. It wasn't led by consumers. It is investors. It was the Human Capital Coalition. You folks may know that outside of Detroit, the ICCR, the impact funds that you are involved with. That has been the driving force of this. So let me ask you this.
Bruce, could I just make a comment on Marvin, just because thank you so much for that, Marvin, because I think one of the key pieces he pointed out here is that there are stakeholders in this conversation, and every stakeholder has a role, right? Whether it's the investors, right? Whether it's the activists and the activism externally, whether it is the board, they have a role.
Absolutely.
Whether it's the workforce. So I think part of what's happening now for how we make it sustainable is that people recognize what can they do within their span of control.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. Every aspect of the system has opportunity to create, has to be engaged in order to create the change that we want that's sustainable.
Absolutely.
So Eric, you're on mute. I wanted to ask you, how does this conversation, in your view, affect investor activism? How does this change the conversation, say, during proxy period? How can we turn this into a constructive process to create change, positive change, rather than turn it into a compliance issue where people engage in diversity theater, check off the boxes, make donations, and then just move on?
Yeah, I have two comments. I agree, the investors have been a driving force, which is also the driving force behind the new SEC 10K rules and human capital reporting rules. That was led by public pension funds, private pension funds, endowments, and the same type of coalition that, including ICCR, which, you know, led on South African, first of all, accountability. And eventually, after compliance, I'm going to say, and I hate to use the word compliance, but just refusal to cooperate, divestiture, which is really the last, the last thing that you want to do. But I would say that the key thing here is that investors are leading, but investors have not figured out how to evaluate so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion and racial equity. Yes, McKinsey has released reports, and there's a whole slew of reports that have been written that, yes, diversity is good for the bottom line. But from an investor standpoint, the analyst that's sitting at his desk at BlackRock, and he's looking at a company, how does he then in turn evaluate that company's commitment to racial equity, and how does that impact the returns that they're seeing from that company, and how does it impact their balance sheet? I grew up in the corporate governance community that the 1986 technical release that created the whole proxy advisory industry. And at the time, we were really trying to work with institutional investors when that cottage industry was created, because most institutional investors didn't see voting proxies as you know, they thought it was just a, you know, a clerical and administrative function, when, you know, voting proxies is essential to how companies, you know, engage in their corporate policies and how they do business. Mm-hmm. And so there was a whole education process, which then evolved into the whole corporate governance advisory community, where investors began to ask questions. Well, you know, if I vote for this particular shareholder resolution, what is the impact on that company? How is it going to, you know, impact the stock price? And there's two types of risk: diversifiable risk, non-diversifiable risk. Diversifiable risk is management risk. Good management, good company. It's a very, very simple notion in finance of being able to evaluate how management is conducting the business of the corporation. And so that became part of a whole regime of advising investors on how to vote on various different corporate governance issues. And I would say finally, you know, as investors are being called to vote on shareholder resolutions around diversity, there's not a great deal of understanding of it. It's really very much in the ivory tower. And as Renee stated, the solution is not from the standpoint of having companies just look at numbers. There has to be a fundamental analysis that has to be done. You know, what types of policies is that company, you know, engaging in? How does that impact the bottom line? And specifically, are they working with communities of color and their organizations? So if you want to do, you want to come up with a corporate policy around, you know, supporting, let's say, legislative initiatives that impact communities of color, how are you having that conversation without talking to, for instance, the National Caucus of Black State Legislators and their policy institutes, or the Ron Walter Center? It's, you can't have these conversations, you can't do good fundamental analysis if you do not engage the organizations that have the expertise, the data, and the experience. Any kind of analysis around racial equity without engaging those communities that are impacted is fundamentally flawed. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get diversity theory.
Yep, that's fabulous.
Well, Renee, you're gonna get the last question because we have a time.
Well, I was gonna say, I just wanted to respond to Eric. I'm having more fun just responding to both, to Eric, to Marvin. But I wanted to say on Eric's comment, you know, it's the notion around data integrity, right? It's kind of, you know, what goes in, good data in, better results, right? Part of data integrity, let me break it down very easily. It's the notion that oftentimes we talk about, we need to do an oversample of marginalized communities, okay? In my mind, it's an inaccurate sample if they're not already included in relative proportion to how they exist in either the marketplace or the community, right? So if the mere fact is that you're still framing it as an oversample, right? You're still thinking them as marginalized, as opposed to an accurate sample as a reflection of the community you seek to engage. It shouldn't have to be that we've got to create a special condition to bring in, to create inclusion. Why is it an oversample? Well, what I'll be talking about, is it an accurate sample? So the language that we use has to change if indeed we actually, for us to be able to better communicate how each person, each individual, each institution, each board, each advisory council, shareholders start to think about this. We shouldn't be seeing people, communities of color, women, people with disabilities, other, any identity that's not the traditional, should not be seen as something that's over sampling. You're not, data, accurate data coming in means it's reflective of the populations, the communities, the markets you seek to engage, and you seek markets, white would see profit. So again, some of this is just, let's make these real lines mean something, you know? So I don't know if that answers a question you were gonna ask me, but it makes me feel better that I appreciate Eric's comment on the approach to data integrity. I'm telling you, people keep asking, oh, display your data, what is it? Is it any good?
Well, Reverend Marvin, I should say, because that's, you're going to get the last question now. It's to me, based on what Renee is saying, that what I've seen to notice, ironically, is that DEI is being segregated in many organizations. And what do I mean by that? They're putting it over in a corner office is saying, okay, here's your budget to give money away to George Floyd causes. Meanwhile, we're going to continue doing things just the way we are. Mm-hmm. So do you think that, and then I noticed that Citibank, you know, is allowing a company, an organization to come in and do a racial equity audit. And to be honest, I'm this is a question to you, Marvin, and then you're going to close it up. My sense is almost, I'm not going to say it's a waste of money. I think we already know the answer, frankly. And that's going to take about 2 years and cost $2 million. But shouldn't we be focused on action also? Shouldn't we be focused on how do we bake DEI into our business operating system so that every executive, every manager, every line manager is responsible for baking DEI into marketing, into sales, into HR, into operations? Are we segregating DEI and should we better integrate it? You get the last answer.
I think you're absolutely right. I think if I were in a courtroom, I think you were leading me a bit, but I will just say to you, yes, we have segregated. It has been segregated. And I think quite frankly, that's because it has not been a business principle. It has not been seen as a business principle. It has been seen as something that we have to do out of a regulatory requirement or something else. But I think that what I've seen when it works the best is that this culture of diversity, equity, and inclusion, it becomes a part of the whole organization. And what that means is that every person that you listed, every manager, every line manager, everyone in the pipeline understands that there's some obligation to do this because we're trying to make our company better. We're trying to get after a market that that's been untapped. We want to expand our opportunities. It's really about a business effort more than just a social effort. Now, listen, I think that the social effort is always good. But what I've also recognized is that when we see DEI segregated into some corner office someplace or, you know, relegated to, beneath the HR person somewhere where, you know, there's really no accountability, then that does not get into the sort of fabric of the firm itself. It doesn't get into the bloodstream of the corporation itself. But when the board, CEO, executives, C-suite, and then there's some measurements and there's some accountability and there's some engagement around how we could do it better, and then there's some investment into expanding and understanding. And I will say this as a person of color, when we think about DEI, when we think we're seeing a company is open to people coming to the conversation, authentically being themselves. Mm-hmm. The other challenge that I've seen is that so often, even people of color, even folks who are in those communities who we're trying to attract, feel almost obligated to fit into a corporate culture. And therefore, they're not being authentically themselves. Mm-hmm. I heard from many employees of companies last summer that said, we saw some things within our own company, but we were afraid to talk about it. We didn't have, there was no space to really talk about it. And companies now, if they're really smart, understand that employees are coming to work, not leaving their values and their concerns at the door, but they're bringing them with them. And what I've seen is companies haven't even been listening to their own people. So a lot of discussion about what's happening externally, but companies are not listening to their own people. And that's a real problem.
Well, Marvin, you've to sum up your wisdom, the current CEO of GE was quoted today in Fortune as saying, people don't want to work for GE anymore. They want to work for a company that's going to change the world. They want to work for a company that has a purpose. And I think in the Great Resignation, we're seeing a lot of talented African-Americans skedaddling from companies that don't really care, and let them find a companies that do. Well, anyway, Renee Redwood, thank you so much. Eric Derisaw, thank you for arranging these terrific panelists. Marvin Owens, thank you for taking the time to join us today. We look forward to seeing you on another EEA show in the future. So have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.